Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
This podcast contains explicit language.
So that happened. This week, the White House celebrated Infrastructure Week, or at least they wanted to, but couldn't, because this week was James Comey a-go-go in the Senate Intelligence Committee. Yes, the former FBI director debuted his testimony in front of an eager gaggle of senators, and he seemed pretty bent on making sure everyone knew that President Donald Trump was a serial liar. The White House, of course, struck back, accusing Comey of leaking privileged information and telling falsehoods of his own. Everyone in D.C. apparently went to a bar to watch these hearings on television because we're a sad bunch of drunks here. And that's Infrastructure Week, so congratulations to Infrastructure. Meanwhile, if you can even remember where the country was a handful of days ago, you might remember last week's big hullabaloo, President Trump's decision to exit the Paris Climate Accords. There was a lot of doomsaying in the wake of this decision, but there were also several renewed commitments made by other American politicians to stay engaged with the rest of the world on this project. So, is Trump's decision going to leave a hole in the planet, or merely create a leadership vacuum for others to fill? We'll try to reckon with what lies ahead. Finally, growing tensions between several Arab states and Qatar blossomed into new antagonism this week as a Saudi-led coalition of states announced they were going to sever their ties with a tiny nation on the Arabian Peninsula. Is the orb involved? It actually kind of is, but President Trump, more importantly, is knit up in this latest mess as well. I'm Jason Linkins with HuffPost reporters Akbar Ahmed, Arthur Delaney, Elise Foley, and Kate Shepard. Here's what happened first. Hello. Hi. Welcome back. Guess what? It's time once again for our little podcast. So that happened here at HuffPost, our week in what we're calling the political discourse, for lack of better words. My name is Jason Linkins. I'm the editor of Eat the Press at HuffPost. Zach Carter, who's normally on this podcast, we'll just dispense this right away. He's on book leave. You know this. He's working on a book called Monopolies Are Great. It will be auto-billed, and it will be auto-delivered to your wireless devices whenever it is published, probably before it's even edited, because no one cares. Joining us today, though, we have Arthur Delaney.
Hi.
That was super enthusiastic. Glad you're with us. And we're very excited. Our friend Elise Foley is here.
I'm happy to be here.
I know you are. Lordy, has it been a week, right? The signature event of this week was the Comey hearing in front of the Senate Intelligence Committee. And dude did not waste time. He came in very hot a day after he put out his statement in advance.
This would be James Comey, the former FBI director.
Yeah, thanks for... Yes, in case anyone out there didn't know that we're talking about James Comey. I don't know any other Comeys, but... He leaned pretty heavily on the idea that Donald Trump is, for the lack of a better word, a liar.
And he did a great job in he did two things that were wonderful. First, he came out and said, I'm not going to read my opening statement, which everyone read the day before.
Right. It went viral, as they say.
And so he delivered a new opening statement in which he said how surprised and confused he was by the Trump administration's justifications for why Trump fired him, which of course obviously made no sense. So it was refreshing to hear his take on the matter.
So it confused me when I saw on television the president saying that he actually fired me because of the Russia investigation. The administration then chose to defame me and, more importantly, the FBI by saying that the organization was in disarray, that it was poorly led, that the workforce had lost confidence in its leader. Those were lies, plain and simple. And I am so sorry that the FBI workforce had to hear them, and I'm so sorry that the American people were told them. I worked every day at the FBI to help make that great organization better.
So it is puzzling because let's walk back through it. When Comey was fired, the first thing you heard was that he was fired because of decisions he made during the election season, specifically pertaining to Hillary Clinton and her email servers, which raised a lot of eyebrows because we didn't know why Donald Trump suddenly cared about that. He spent most of the election season suggesting that Clinton belonged locked up because of her email server. Then it came out because Trump said it on television that he fired Comey because of the Russia investigation, and then told other people through channels that it relieved a lot of pressure to have Comey gone and the Russian investigation imperiled. Am I missing something? Am I crazy?
No, I don't think so. I mean,
crazy pills?
One of the things that was interesting to was hearing Comey sort of say that he was just as surprised by Trump saying that as everyone else. All of us were like, wow, you're just going to admit that that's why you did it? And it sounds like Comey was surprised by that, too. And then he went on to say a few times during the hearing that he was fired because of his handling, that Trump didn't like something about how he was handling the Russia investigation. So having that just be kind of a fact now is pretty striking when originally they were trying to, you know, come up with other reasons they did it.
Yeah, it's not supposed to take it's supposed to take a long time to ferret out such damning facts. And they've actually just been laid bare by Trump himself for so long that the entire story is actually kind of bizarre. It feels like deja vu. Because we already know, because Trump said himself, I fired James Comey because he was investigating my campaign's possible ties to Russia.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that I think the Trump administration has fixated on in the hopes that it'll be somewhat exculpatory is the fact that if you remember in the memo that the Trump administration put out when Comey was fired, they made specific mention of three occasions on which Comey said he was not under investigation, that Trump personally was not under investigation. In Comey's statement that he put out in advance, he accounted for all three of those times. Puzzlingly, one of the three times was a time where Trump suggested that maybe the FBI should go all out in an investigation of the Steele dossier in the hopes of debunking it, and Comey had to explain to him, well, if we do that, then I wouldn't be able to say there wasn't an active investigation of you ongoing.
This would be the dossier that describes Trump like peeing on, or hookers peeing.
Yes, among other things.
And Trump watching, I think.
Yes, that's the thing most people remember about the Steele dossier. But there were other things in there too. It was essentially a raft of signals intelligence that a guy working for picked up out of the ether. A lot of it has not been confirmed, but there was an implication today during Comey's testimony that it's still a matter that needs to be discussed in closed session, which leads me to believe that there's still something about it that people are taking really deadly seriously, P-tape aside. But do you think that this is ultimately like exculpatory?
No, it's such a non sequitur. Trump's lawyer came out after Comey's testimony and said Comey confirmed that my client is not under direct investigation for colluding with Russia.
Not is, was.
Right, which is
– because is now – that verb tense means a lot now, because he did say during the hearing today that he's sure – quote, sure, that Robert Mueller, who's been appointed special counsel, is investigating the Trump administration for obstruction.
Right. And it's just a non sequitur. That's what we're looking at now, whether Trump's firing of James Comey itself was corrupt, whether that itself was obstruction of justice. At least you covered the hearing for us.
You see them do this a lot, right? Like, they always come out and say, look, Trump won the election. Nobody is saying that Russia, you know, hacked the election so that Trump didn't win. And it's like, yeah, that's true. You know, everybody who says that Russia messed with the election also says that, correct, Trump is president. So they kind of try to divert people with stuff like this. But yeah, I mean, absolutely. At this point, the story, I think, and the investigation, a lot of it in terms of Trump personally is whether he tried to obstruct justice here and pressure Comey into dropping it, as Comey says that he did.
So, Elise, you watched the hearing really closely and did stories on it for us. Senators asked Comey if he thought there was obstruction of justice on Trump's part. And did Comey say no?
I don't believe he ever specifically said yes, but he didn't say no either. I mean, there was just this like crazy parsing of words over how he said that he Trump said, according to Comey, that he hoped that he would sort of drop the Flynn investigation.
That was Jim Risch, Idaho senator, who made a big point of trying to assuage fears that I hope you will let go of this was just sort of a casual conversation and not some kind of leaning into obstruction.
I hope, this is the president speaking, I hope you can see your way clear to letting this go, to letting Flynn go. He is a good guy. I hope you can let this go. He did not direct you to let it go.
Not in his words, no.
He did not order you to let it go.
Again, those words are not an order.
No. He said, I hope. Now, like me, you probably did hundreds of cases, maybe thousands of cases, charging people with criminal offenses. And, of course, you have knowledge of the thousands of cases out there that where people have been charged. Do you know of any case where a person has been charged for obstruction of justice, or for that matter, any other criminal offense, where this they said or thought they hoped for an outcome?
I don't know well enough to answer. I took it as a direction.
Right.
I mean, as the President of the United States, with me alone saying, I hope this, I took it as this is what he wants me to do. Now, I didn't obey that, but that's the way I took it.
You may have taken it as a direction, but that's not what he said.
Correct.
He said, I hope.
Those are exact words. Okay. Correct.
You don't know of anyone that's ever been charged for hoping something. Is that a fair statement?
I don't as I sit here.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
It seems like if you were the Trump administration, you'd want there to be something firmer to say about yourself than just, oh, well, yesterday it was, oh, they were having a New York conversation. You know, and today it was just a light conversation, lighthearted.
Like, yeah, Comey, don't be so dramatic.
Yeah, exactly.
You misunderstood. It's no big deal. He was just saying he hopes it, not that you have to.
Right.
And Comey said, though, that, you know, he's the president. We were in this room together. I felt, even if he didn't use the words, I direct you to do this, that I hope that you'll do this. He felt that that was Trump directing.
He ordered everyone out of the room.
So he was very clear that, you know, whether that's what Trump said those words or not, that's how he took it.
It's so clear that that was an attempt to thwart an investigation that we're almost left with nothing more to say. And Comey, you know, they asked him, is this obstruction of justice in your opinion? He's like, well, you know, that'll be up for Robert Mueller, who's the special counsel that the FBI has appointed.
Now, he expressed a lot of confidence in Robert Mueller. The two men have history. One of the more interesting things that came out, of course, in the hearing was that in obtaining the special counsel, Comey leaked memos to a friend of his. This is something else that Trump's lawyers now super upset about. What can you tell us about that whole situation?
Yeah. So the way that these memos were initially reported, where Comey said or Trump reportedly, according to Comey, said to him, I hope that you'll, you know, let this Michael Flynn thing go. That came out in a New York Times story. And so Comey said today that during the testimony that he had given that memo to a friend of his, a Columbia Law professor, and that friend, you know, with Comey's permission, had given it or told the New York Times about it. So basically, he talked a lot about how he kept all these notes about his meetings with Trump, in part because he was worried that Trump might lie about their meetings and what went on. So he, you know, was saying that, yeah, he took those notes and he put them out there for that reason. But the Trump people are trying to imply that, you know, by doing that, and, you know, even the word leaks is a little tricky there in terms of as a technical term, that by doing that, he did something wrong. And what he said is like, look, these are my notes. I'm a private citizen. I can release them to my friend if I want.
Wasn't Trump himself describing these meetings to reporters repeatedly?
Yeah, and Comey said he, you know, specifically tried in his notes to not, you know, he purposefully put no classified information in them, basically so that he could release them, I think, at some point.
And yet the Trump's lawyer is calling those communications classified and also privileged. And that's been, I can tell you, that's been confusing to a lot of people. A lot of people can't fathom how on earth that conversation was privileged in any way.
Well, it's like they're claiming that anything that the president says, you're not allowed to repeat because he said it in private.
Trump's lawyer also denies.
No, it's not how it works.
Now, Comey has been crystal clear in saying that Trump said to him, I expect loyalty, which is a key statement for creating this potential patronage relationship that would be basically corrupt. So Trump's lawyer came out and said, Trump did not say that in any way, shape, or form.
But yet he also said that Trump feels entitled to loyalty. All
yeah, he's like, he didn't say that, but Comey should be loyal.
Which he could have. It would have been fine.
Which fatally undermines the own claim. And,
how do you not sound like a heavy when you say that?
And then, okay, if we're going to have a contest of he said, how does the Trump administration expect to win when they have been brazenly lying for years? When Donald Trump launches political career as a birther.
Do you want to get to the point where vaccines and autism?
He says vaccines cause autism. Right, yeah, he says Rafael Cruz killed JFK.
Well, assisted in the killing.
He says New Jersey Muslims cheered the 9/11 attacks.
Yes.
He says 3 million people voted for Hillary Clinton illegally, and that therefore he actually won the popular vote, which he obviously lost. He's been lying a blue streak his entire career, and now you want to actually have he said?
Okay. The White House says that he's not a liar, which is in itself a lie.
This was so rich. While the Comey testimony was happening, they sent Sarah Huckabee Sanders into a off-camera briefing just to say, the president is not a liar.
It's insulting that anyone would even ask. That's what she said.
Don't lie so much if you don't want to be called a liar. How can you not call him a liar?
It's beyond me. I mean, I will say that Comey noted twice that there was a press conference where Trump denied asking Comey to stop the Flynn investigation. We know that's a lie. Also, the Lester Holt interview, he said that Comey initiated contact in one of those meetings. He said that Comey requested. We know that's a lie too. Those are, I mean,
a small pointless lie.
Which is what people who lie a lot do.
And you know,
do small pointless lies as well.
We should talk about the pointlessness of all of this. There's right now the case that's being made against Trump doesn't really have anything to do with collusion with Russians, at least personal collusion. So obviously, we can't say anything about the people who Trump surrounded himself with. And notably, according to Comey, Trump can't say that either because Trump at one point said it would be great to investigate satellite people in my orbit to see if they had anything to do with it because that would be bad.
Oh, yeah. Please catch the people around me who are committing crimes.
Yes. We may not end up with anything that points to Donald Trump as a guy who was literally in cahoots with Russians. But if he had left Comey at the FBI, all of this might have just petered out. All of this might have just sort of like blown away. There wouldn't be Robert Mueller looking under every rock. It's extraordinary how unnecessary this needed to be. And it's all down to the fact that Donald Trump said you can't be an independent agency director of the FBI. You have to sign up and be loyal to me. I need your fealty, not your independence. It's just like so crazy to me. All of this maybe could have been avoided.
I'm glad it's not. I mean, let's get this revealed
something about the president.
If I, you know,
it's
if
the
I,
most transparent administration in history for sure.
If I keep people roll slowed on the whole collusion thing, it's because I don't want to get completely out over my skis on that.
We're not talking about that. We're talking about obstruction of justice.
It is very clear that the obstruction of justice case is perhaps makeable at this point, and it needn't have been. It needn't have been, especially if Donald Trump didn't do anything wrong. I mean, that's his position, right? I didn't do anything wrong. If he didn't do anything wrong, why is he all mess? He does things consistently that makes us think that he knows how the story is going to end and that's not going to end well.
I don't understand the idea. This is what the defense Republicans are getting to, that he's too incompetent to have really intentionally obstructed justice.
He's new to this. That was what Paul Ryan said.
Okay. Okay. So, all right. Say he gets a pass ultimately on this whole thing. He's just going to do it again. He's just going to do something else corrupt. And he's proven that he is who he always has appeared to be.
His lawyer said that he feels entitled to loyalty. Right. That's the situation for the new FBI director.
Yeah, they're not only saying he didn't do it. They're saying that he could have and would have been in his rights to do it.
Yeah, they're so not.
There's clearly no remorse there or feeling that, you know, maybe I should have acted differently, or at least publicly.
So if he gets past this thing, it'll just be the next thing. So I don't. To me, it seems like Republicans should not be trying to drag out the Trump administration.
At some point, what I wonder is at what point are they going to have to say, okay, he's not new to this anymore. He should know better.
You would think, you know, after he became the president.
Yeah, that would be nice. I just think I find it wild to, you know, say, yeah, I really thought that this guy should be president who, you know, I don't really think knows how to be president.
You know, it's people talk about like sort of the big things that go on with Trump, like his policy beliefs, his sort of retrograde views on immigration, his anti-Islamic stance. But the thing about the Trump administration that I think is most fascinating are all the own goals. You know, you run out a travel ban without consulting with agencies that can help you avoid pitfalls. You bring Russians into your office and joke around with them the day after – well, not the day after, but like soon after Comey was fired. You tell them Comey was a nut job.
He didn't have to have those meetings with Comey where he said those things at all. He didn't have to meet with him. That's not a regular occurrence for the president and FBI director to be meeting.
You don't get intelligence briefings. Consequently, you don't know that there's a massive military base in Qatar. And that it's all these little own goals of incompetence. And the funny thing is that there's no one around him who's willing to be an adult and say, we need changes so you can be a more effective president. These guys, prior to the Comey hearing, were all trying to come up with some way to keep Trump from watching television or tweeting about the Comey hearings. You know what you do? You just say, don't do that. Stop. Don't do that. You're hurting yourself. The fact that these guys all don't know how to manage him is crazy at this point.
The fact that he needs to be managed is a little crazy at this point.
It's crazy. You can do – he could be a much more effective president. I'm not arguing that that would be good for any of us. But he would be a more effective president if some adult in the room would be like, look, I need to teach you how to do shit. I need to teach you what you need to do to be in this office.
I mean, ultimately, he didn't live tweet the hearing and he didn't say anything about it during a speech. So there's – he cleared that very low bar. For yes. himself.
Is our Trump's learning?
Yeah.
Yeah. Congratulations.
He became president.
In that moment, he became still an idiot. Still an idiot. Anyway, there's obviously going to be more to this coming up. I mean, one of the things that was very interesting was there was a lot of talk about what would be going on in closed sessions. Speaking of sessions, one of those things that Comey said were that there were facts that the public doesn't know yet about why he ultimately recused himself from Russia.
It's Attorney General Jeff Sessions.
Yeah, Attorney General Jeff Sessions. So I think that there's going to be a lot more leaks to come once the closed part of these hearings happen, and then we'll see what goes on from there.
No doubt. More leaks.
Quite a week. All right. We have a really good show. We're going to talk about other things that aren't about Comey. So please stick around. We'll be right back.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And we're back. So last week, I promised we would talk about the Paris Climate Accords, which President Donald Trump has elected to walk away from in some way, shape, or form. He's promised to renegotiate them. They've been negotiated over the course of many, many years. So it's very confusing what's happening. What's more confusing is, of course, the effect of walking away from Paris. Will it create literal environmental havoc? Or will it just simply open a leadership vacuum that the United States used to fill? Either one could be pretty bad. Here to talk about it, we have Arthur Delaney, of course.
Hi.
You're on every segment. I don't know why I keep introducing you. And we're very fortunate to have with us, before she jets off to North Carolina, Kate Shepard.
Hi, thanks for having me.
No, I'm grateful to have you here because you know more about this than I think probably anyone here. So take us through the Paris Climate Accord, let's just start here. What was it trying to do?
The Paris Climate Accord was an attempt to get every country in the world together to come forward with a set of commitments to reduce our emissions. It is a voluntary agreement. Every country comes with their own contribution that they have made up themselves. There's not some kind of top-down, you, U.S., have to meet this number, and you, China, have to meet this number. Every country was able to come and say, here's what works for us and our economy and our timeline. It was signed in 2015, but it's been this almost – at this point, it's been 25 years. This has been in the process that the international negotiators have been trying to reach some kind of agreement that all these world leaders could come together on.
Right. Now, you say it's not a top-down agreement. No one's forced to do anything. But American leadership, from what I've been led to believe, still played a critical role in putting this coalition together.
I mean – the reason we have the Paris Accord is that we had the Kyoto Agreement in, you know, the late 90s, early 2000s, in which the U.S. initially said that they'd be part of. And then when George W. Bush came into office, said, you know, never mind, we're actually not going to do this. And, you know, their major opposition was that China and India were not involved and they were the major emerging emitters. And so it took this, you know, another almost 15 years to get a new agreement that included China and India and the U.S. And that was really the U.S. insisting that they be part of it as well. And the major reason it is a voluntary agreement and not a treaty in the sense that you normally have from the U.N. is because the Obama administration knew that they couldn't get a treaty approved by Republicans in the Congress. So they were trying to get – you know, basically they're trying to get what they could on, you know, together with other nations, despite the fact that we have political challenges here in the U.S.
So the idea of this is to reduce the amount of pollution that countries are making so that the world doesn't heat up and icebergs melt and Miami is underwater.
And we die.
We're probably
fine, but yeah.
Our children or our grandchildren will be drowning. So does withdrawing from that treaty make it more likely – like, is that going to actually start happening more quickly as a direct result of the U.S. withdrawing from this treaty? Not a treaty, you know, agreement.
I mean, given that climate change is a global problem and that, you know, we don't – it's not like our emissions aggregate over our head and not over the rest of the world. It's like we are not taking part into the collective action in the way that we were before. And that's – I mean, that's dangerous for a lot of reasons. One, because the U.S. is a major emitter. We're not the biggest anymore, but we're still a really big emitter. And so us not doing the things that we said we were going to do is bad emissions-wise. I mean, the deal was written in a way that, you know, leaders are committing to trying to keep warming below 2 degrees Celsius. And that's, you know, most estimates show that we're probably going to go past that anyway. But it was a set of things that we were going to do to try to prevent that from happening. And so having the U.S. not take part in that it's bad for our emissions total. But I think the bigger concern is that it's bad for us as far as being a partner in the international community and seeing this as a common threat that we need to work together to solve.
Now, that sounds a little more symbolic. Like, this, it makes us look bad as leaders, given that we're the biggest polluters per capita.
Well, it's symbolic, but it's also practical, right? Like, if the U.S. doesn't meet what it said it was going to do, why does China have to meet what they said they're going to do? And, you know, long term, that would be a huge concern. Now, China has said that they're going to do it anyway because they see it as important for their health and well-being of their people, but also for them economically speaking, they see it as an advantage to grow into the clean energy space.
There are some economic factors at work here, of course. Renewable energy sources are growing less and less expensive. Donald Trump can't make them more expensive. Coal industry worldwide is experiencing a decline. Even in India, which was on pace to be a coal emitter par excellence, the coal industry there has suffered some steep declines. I mean, there are some economic forces that are driving this situation too, beyond just the accord, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, almost all of the reduction we've seen in the use of coal in the U.S. is because natural gas has gotten cheaper, and because wind and solar have gotten cheaper, and you see a lot of utilities making decisions to install those and not new coal plants for economic reasons, not only because it will be easier to meet emission attainment goals.
So what are some of the things that regular people in the U.S. might expect to happen as a potential result of this? You know, for instance, we've got emission standards for cars that are making them more fuel efficient. Is that going to get rolled back as a result? Or, you know, will someone from the EPA come into your living room and turn off your lights while you're watching TV?
Well, so the Trump administration, I mean, beyond withdrawing formally from the Paris Accord or attempting to has also started rolling back rules about automobiles. They've also started trying to roll back the rules about power plants. And so under the Obama administration, we saw improvements in the CAFE standards, fuel economy standards for automobiles that they're trying to push back. You have automakers who have been making more efficient cars in response to that, which is why it's become easier to buy a fuel-efficient car in the U.S. because of those rules. And so we might see some reduction of that, and then consumers might just have fewer fuel-efficient options on the market if automakers aren't being compelled to produce them. Most people kind of don't really notice where their electricity comes from and what their utility derives their power from. But you might see fewer switching to gas or coal or wind or solar.
But power companies do say stuff like, oh, these standards are going to cost you a fortune. And yet I don't see, you know, it's you don't like go into the marketplace and purchase electricity. There's just like a utility.
Right. Like usually you have one choice and that's what you get. Right. I mean, there have been an increasing number of alternatives on the market where you can have power purchase agreements. So you're buying wind or solar. But most people don't even notice where their power is coming from. But you might see change. Your utility might be changing their long term thinking based on these changes at the Trump administration. And also you sort of see this kind of cascading effects of state level policy as well. In a number of states, they've made programs so it's cheaper to put solar panels on your house that you can get tax credits. And
yes,
you might see states a lot of states have committed to doing them anyway, but there is potential that states could start changing their mind or not put in place policies of that sort because there's no longer going to be the incentive from the federal government that there was going to be under the Obama era.
So one of the allegations that Donald Trump made about the Paris Accords, and I don't know, this sounds like it may be cynical and false, but you tell me. He said that the entire arrangement was simply he made it sound like a global conspiracy to just steal America's money.
I know. They're laughing at us.
Yes.
That is what he said. They're laughing at us.
Yes.
Echoes of Adolf Hitler.
So any truth to that? Are they making off with our money?
No.
Okay. Cynical and false.
Cynical and false. And also the laughing at us. I mean, if anything, they're now like – is that we're not being made fun of for walking back from something that the rest of the world agrees on.
We were the catalyst of this agreement. We were hardly being laughed at. We were the people who put it together.
Right. And if anything, the pressure from other countries was that it should have been tougher and that they were not necessarily totally happy that it was voluntary and they would have liked to have seen a treaty. I mean, the reason it's weaker than it could have been is because of the U.S.
So there was a lot of doomsaying the day he went to the Rose Garden and gathered a jazz band and celebrated pulling out of the
There was a lot
agreement.
Of literal doomsaying.
Yeah, a lot of doomsaying.
It was very Titanic.
Yeah, Titanic was one of the metaphors and memes of the day. But here's some things we've learned since then. We've learned that China is going to continue to honor their commitments, which is huge for the collective action of all the partners. we understand that India is, I think, at least a year ahead on their commitments, which were also pretty vast. And we've seen people across this country, mayors, corporations, stepping up to try to fill this vacuum, say, we will continue to push for these changes and demonstrate some leadership. Is it possible that all Trump may end up doing, and I'll ask you to explain the whole like deadline to pull out in a minute, but over the next 4 years is just abandon a personal leadership role in a major global commitment that would be filled by other countries or other Americans?
I mean, I certainly think that the efforts from states and cities, and even like you have regional agreements on climate change, like
right.
the Northeast has one, the Pacific Coast has one. I think those are very important, and they'll probably go a long way toward meeting the goals anyway. But you know, it's going to the laggard states who weren't going to act without a federal push are just not going to act,
might
and those are
enough,
important.
Might it be enough to keep the spirit of the other partnerships agreement invested in it, that it's not a total abandonment by America writ large?
I mean, maybe.
I mean, Justin Trudeau was very, very pointed about this when he tweeted about it. He said that it was America's federal government that pulled out of the climate accord. He sort of left everybody else off the hook.
Yeah. I mean, I do think those things are important, but the leadership from the federal level is also really important. I mean, this is kind of how we got ourselves through the Bush administration as well, right? Like, that's why we had the Northeast Agreement. This is why a lot of other states took action. And it's like, it's nice and it's good, but it doesn't take the place of federal leadership.
Okay. One last thing. My understanding is that the declaration that we're out of the Paris Agreement, it's kind of weirdly like Brexit. It doesn't take place right away, and people say that the date certain that we would be out if nothing else changes would be the day after the election. Why
in 2020?
In 2020, yeah, sorry, in 2020. So why is that? That doesn't make sense to me.
Oh, I mean, that's kind of more like this is like how bureaucratic processes work at the UN. Like nothing happens so very fast, and it's like they don't want people to be able to say like we're leaving tomorrow, so they build in these kind of
bureaucratic
bric-a-brac, right?
Okay.
Yeah, so that you can't just leave tomorrow. But and also just I mean for people to understand like these negotiations to bring together 190 countries to work on these things. It's a very slow process. So even getting the agreement took a really long time. And then affirming how do you meet all these goals that you've put forward? And how do you – I mean, one of the biggest debates in writing the accord in the first place was like how do you actually monitor and verify that your partners are doing the things that they said they're going to do? And so there is this sort of very long process.
It's been a long time since the climate was an election issue. I know that climate activists were miffed throughout the 2016 election that no one was bringing these issues up in debates, that none of the presidential candidates were compelled to talk about this. Is it possible that this could become one of the key issues in the 2020 election? And are climate activists equipped to make it an issue?
It's a tough one. I mean, I feel like every election we're like, this is the election that climate change is going to be really important. And when you do polls, the majority of Americans do care about this issue and want their leaders to address it. But it's never the number one issue. It's,
sure.
you know,
economy.
Five.
They'll care
sometimes
about anything
sometimes
if
it's
you
10.
Ask
yeah.
You
I mean,
care
I
about
think,
this? Yeah.
Yeah. But I think people actually, you know, people don't want to see the world like, you know, destroyed. It's generally seen as a bad thing, but it is lower down the list. And so I think it's always going to be competing with those more immediate challenges that people face as an election issue. But if there is a big pushback from the international community about this, or if there are some climate-related disasters, I mean, those could change the calculus quite
sure.
a bit.
Well, let's hope there's no climate-related disasters. Not rooting for bad things to happen. All right, Kate, thanks for joining us today. We will be right back. Hey, So That Happened listeners. I want to let you know about a new podcast that HuffPost has just launched. Yes, it's true. HuffPost does have other podcasts. This one is called IVFML, and it follows one couple through the hilarious, depressing, ridiculous, and expensive travails of trying to have a baby whilst struggling with infertility. We've got a little promo for you, and if it piques your interest, well, all 5 episodes of the series are available for download right now. Here you go.
Hi, I'm Anna.
And I'm Simon.
We've been married for 6 years and everything's been super good.
Awesome. Great to hear that.
But there's been one big sort of headline problem.
We're infertile. We were so goddamn happy. I remember you gave me this phone call. You just said, baby, 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 baby. You just said that like 100 times on the phone. I was so excited. And I just remember walking around the block in circles.
Yeah, at that point, it had already been 1.5 years since we'd been trying.
Fuck, it had already been 1.5 years?
Yeah.
Fuck.
But our mission didn't work. Our happy feelings lasted about 48 hours. There's something really wrong. There's something really wrong with this pregnancy.
I remember stuffing my phone in my pocket and all the emotion dropping out of the ultrasound tech's voice as she called for the doctor.
I remember thinking, why the hell did I tell so many people about this?
IVFML, a new HuffPost podcast. 5 episodes that we're releasing all at once. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts.
And we're back. So ever since Donald Trump has taken office, a lot of us have looked around the world for those kind of crazy, exogenous events that a normal president might be able to handle, but that a President Trump might cock up, let's just say. This week, something akin to that kind of event brewed up in the Middle East. The Saudi government has led a coalition of other Arab states in an isolation move on the nation of Qatar. Fresh off of Trump's visit, to talk about this, we're going to have Arthur Delaney.
Hi.
And Akbar Ahmed.
Hello.
Once again, back. You know, there's foreign policy doings when Akbar is on the show. Akbar, first of all, how do we pronounce this nation?
So it's not Stephanie Qatar. I had to clear that up to someone the other day. It's also not Qatar. It is Qatar.
Okay. So
Qatar.
All right. I'm going to screw
it. It is the state of Qatar. It's okay. Not a kingdom. It's the state.
Right. Okay. All right. Qatar. I'll just pronounce it the bad way.
And it's geographically right in the middle.
Yes.
In between Saudi Arabia and Iran.
Yes.
One of the things that I think we have to provide listeners is a little bit of the backstory. Sure. Because Qatar has been it's been a regional rivalry with the Saudi government, with the Emiratis, with the Bahrainians before. What is it that has what's the backstory on this whole the relationship between these nations?
So Qatar is like really tiny. Like Qatar has 800,000 people, right? It's this small peninsula that juts off the main Arabian Peninsula. Its only land route is through Saudi Arabia. So Qatar's big nightmare in its existence is that the Saudis will one day just walk in and say, you're basically part of us anyway. So Qatar hedged its bets a long time ago in the 70s by offering to pay for and build the biggest American military base in the Middle East. Qatar is now home to between 10,000 and 11,000 American troops. It's where all the fighter jets bombing ISIS take off from. And it's just, as Arthur mentioned, between Saudi and Iran. I think what happened this week was, you mentioned President Trump, and I don't think this sort of thing would have happened if we hadn't had a President Trump.
Really?
The Saudis and the Emiratis have disliked Qatar for a long time. They dislike Qatar. They say it's because Qatar is close to Iran, which is really like an unfair kind of statement.
It's geographically true.
It is geographically true. However, Qatar, you know, Qatar and Iran are about as close as the United Arab Emirates and Iran. It's not very different. But really, it's about popular uprisings and political unrest. Qatar has supported around the region democracy activists, uprisings against sinning regimes, and that is the ultimate nightmare.
So they've added creatine to the scene, the Arab Spring.
Of the Arab Spring. Absolutely. In Tunisia, in Egypt, in Libya, in Syria, they have been saying, we will fund you, we will help you, we will get your legitimacy.
The Saudis and Emiratis would prefer the stability of the old regime.
They like this idea of the, what the Emiratis call the secular autocrat, right? Very arguably secular.
Sure, yeah, okay.
But they've hated the Qataris for a long time. They said, why are you doing this? Also, why do you run Al Jazeera? Qatar's marquee media property, huge in English, even bigger in Arabic, and hugely influential. Al Jazeera often has people who are opposition activists or human rights groups, people saying, this regime in Bahrain or Saudi Arabia is doing X or Y. That's where a lot of the anger comes from. They've been wanting to punish Qatar for a long time. And last week, just before this happened, I actually got some emails from the Emirati ambassador to the United States, a really interesting figure called Yusuf Al-Otaiba, where he explicitly just tells people, I want to shut down the American base. Why aren't we doing that yet? You know, I mean, it's really salacious stuff. These are countries that are close neighbors, right? That's like, you know, that's like an American state telling another American state, I just want to shut you down. And it's really unreal the level of anti-Qatar stuff that's been brewing. Now let's go to President Trump. If you remember, there was an article in like October of last year by someone called Selena, something really annoying individual. And it basically said, take Trump seriously, but not literally.
There was a lot of that.
Yeah. A lot of this.
It was always very annoying. Yeah.
And it's always hugely annoying. Trump went to Saudi Arabia in late May. He met with the leaders of Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, other countries. I think, based on my conversations with sources, that they took him seriously, but not literally. Trump literally said, I want to pull together all my Arab partner countries and we will stand against terror. Right? He said, that's what I'm doing.
The orb that played a part
of
it.
The orb. The orb indeed.
You might remember the orb from last week, which we are still going to steal. And I'm very disappointed that none of you have emailed me about stealing the orb. Please send us an email at sethathappened@huffingtonpost.com. Subject, steal the orb.
Okay. Hugely important. So they gathered around the orb and Trump literally said, we are all together now. We are friends. But the Saudis and the Emiratis took him seriously. What they thought was Trump has said he's against Islam. He's against Islam generally, but he's also against Islam in politics, which is what Qatar supports.
Islamist politics.
Right.
Yes.
They perceive this as Trump is telling us, go ahead and do whatever you want. If you remember, Trump also gave the Saudis a $110 billion arms package.
Well, I thought that was fake news.
Arguably, and we can get into that. But the point is, the symbolism was there of Trump saying, here's all this money.
Sure,
right?
Sure, okay.
The symbolism was there regardless
the
of whether it's
there.
Real.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I'm with you there.
So the Saudis and the Emiratis were like, wow, the president loves us. We can do whatever we want.
I mean, they laid it on pretty thick when he went over there. I mean,
absolutely.
They put his name on, put his face on billboards. They projected his image on a hotel.
On a huge hotel.
Gave him a necklace.
Yeah,
it was a very shiny necklace.
Yeah, they went out of their way to flatter him. And I think that, you know, cynically, I'll say it was probably the smartest move you could make.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the kind of guy he is. And I think that's what precipitated them saying on Monday morning, look, we've been wanting to strike Qatar for a while. Let's just do it. And the Emiratis, the Saudis cut off relations with Qatar. Bahrain does, Egypt does, and Yemen does. Now there's about, I think, 9 countries and then 2 more which have downgraded relations with Qatar.
And so Trump praised that.
Trump said that was good.
Yes. So Trump, like,
even though our base is there.
Yeah. And I mean, there are 10,000 American troops there whose lives, you know, depend on Qatar's goodwill.
Is there going to be a war over there, a new war?
I don't think so.
Okay. Because people say this is the Saudis and the Iranians could have a war.
Right.
And this is their proxies arranging themselves.
Had Trump not backtracked, so as you mentioned, like Trump weighed in on one side of the dispute. Briefly.
Yeah.
Trump ever so briefly attacked Qatar in 3 tweets and said, the Saudis are right and correct and do whatever you want. And that's all he said on the matter. And then he called the Qatari ruler and said, I'm really sorry, let's make up. And this was the action of some HR McMaster, you know, Javanka, whoever is whispering in his ear. Trump has not pushed this problem.
What a mess.
Tussle.
Okay.
But that's still a mess.
Another thing happened that I'm sure everyone heard about, which was the ISIS attack in Iran.
Yeah.
Now, does that make the situation even more volatile?
I would say it makes it a tougher situation for the Saudis and the Emiratis, who thought they were going to get away with anything they wanted in this era. And not because there's a lot of conspiracy theories. The Iranians are saying the Saudis did it. The Saudis don't control ISIS. ISIS attacks Saudi Arabia frequently all the time. But there is now a wellspring of sympathy for Iran, which has never been hit by ISIS in this way. And it's their parliament. And let's not forget, they gave us a huge demonstration of how, to some degree, they do have elections. They have democracy. So they struck the parliament, and Qatar is looking isolated, and that's all looking messed up. So Saudi Arabia is looking pretty bad right now. No one is sympathetic towards them. Everyone is sympathetic towards their opponents. I think we're going to see a lot of Saudi backpedaling. They'll have to do it in some way that saves face. But luckily, they have 10,000 members of their royal family, so they can always trot out another prince, if, you know.
So thanks to Trump's backpedaling and where regional sympathies are at the moment, you don't think the situation will continue to escalate? Because commentators on TV and Twitter this week were saying, what a mess. This is bad.
I just said what a mess, actually.
Commentators!
Commentators on TV, Twitter, and podcasts.
Sitting right next to you.
No, I mean, I don't think it's going to – I don't think it's going to be a military involvement. I think that Trump really got taken unawares. And as you were saying, Jason, like, we – it's always interesting to see how he reacts to exogenous events. And in this instance, he clearly tweeted out before thinking, before talking, before even looking at what
Jim
Mattis –
siding with the people who lavished him with praise with, and
necklaces.
Yeah, necklaces.
Yeah, it's really simple. Yeah, really, that's Trump doctrine, like, shiny.
It's an easy
I
game.
I like it.
Show him shiny bauble.
Right.
The orb.
And something like this, where the situation is actually extremely complicated, Trump will not. Trump may be inclined to listen to people who understand it better.
That's a very good
point. Stop from doing his blundering.
Especially because in this kind of situation, I think we also have to, I hate to speak about the president this way, but like I think we have to see him as like driven by a couple of things. And I don't think that anything here is that interesting to him.
It's too complicated.
It's too complicated. There's no easy thing that he can get of, like, feeling strong, standing next to people in military uniforms, getting money. You know what I mean?
Like, Akbar, this is the way everyone should think about the president. And because he's the president, people have been extremely hesitant to think this way for his whole political career. But the truth is, he's not a complicated man.
Right.
He's not cunning. The whole idea
and
of being demagoguery is, you know, there's a stigma against that because it's so effective.
And he showed
so
no
bad.
Interest in like learning the complexities. I mean, he has access now to some of the leading foreign policy experts in the world. He could learn so much about the world he lives in,
please.
But he chooses
President
not to.
President Nixon/Trump did have Henry Kissinger in the Oval Office.
Jason,
let's
true.
Not forget that.
That's true. Fresh off of Henry Kissinger's blurb on Jared in the Time 100. Yeah, I remember that.
Well, anyway, I think it seems like you've got the right way of looking at Trump based on how Trump has acted in every situation, not just foreign policy ones, that he is a simple man.
This has got to be one of those times, though, when the fact that he has access to Twitter like nearly got
it. It was a huge problem. That day on Tuesday when he issued these tweets, Tuesday morning, it really seemed as though something very bad could happen and a military invasion. If you could imagine a Saudi invasion of a country hosting a base with 10,000 American troops, I mean, that would be unreal.
It would be surreal.
But I you know, when we talked last week about Trump doctrine, our allies across the world understand that the president is simple and that his unvarnished thoughts are what he tweets, and that you don't take that as U.S. policy. Because people like H.R. McMaster will be there to clean up the mess or explain, you know, this is what we're really doing.
It's still, I think, really problematic because we have some of our allies, we'll call Saudi Kingdom an ally, who will go out of the way to pay this man tribute, and others that will just continue to try to be straight with him, like our European allies. And you see who he favors when he has to make a split decision to support or not support. You see who he favors. He favors the people who lavish attention on
him. And you see what backfires.
Flatter him.
I think is important too. The Saudi bet did not pay off in the end. Yeah,
that's true. Interesting. Well, Akbar, thanks for joining us. This is hugely complicated part of the world. Grateful to have you explain it to
me.
Us. We will be right back. Thank you. So that's what happened this week. This podcast was produced, edited, and engineered by Zach Young. Our executive producer is Nick Offenberg. I'm Jason Lincolns, and this week we were joined by HuffPost reporters Akbar Ahmed, Arthur Delaney, Elise Foley, and Kate Shepard. So That Happened is available on iTunes at itunes.com/sothathappened. Check out the whole family of HuffPost podcasts, including our new IVFML, in the iTunes store. And while you're there, subscribe and tell your friends. If there's something you'd like to hear us talk about, send an email to sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. Thanks to all of you for listening, and we miss you already.